Welcome to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast with your hosts, Richard Hill and Matthew Darlitz.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. My name is Matthew Darlitz, Editor-in-Chief of the Science of Psychotherapy. And as always, I'm here with Richard Hill. Howdy, Richard.
Howdy, Matt. How are you doing up there in sunny Queensland? I'm down here in sort of half sunny, bit of rainy Sydney.
Yeah, doing well. Well, apart from being beaten up by a severe hailstorm the other week, we're okay.
Oh yes, you did. They were big. They were like cricket balls, and
they were
golf balls. And anyway, as we're getting wild weather all around the place, but that's the time of year for it.
Right.
But yes,
we've been missing in action for a little bit. We've been busy.
We did
with all sorts of things. So glad to be back.
Yes, and I hope people noticed. I'm sure they did.
Maybe not.
No, we just missed a couple of episodes, but here we are. I want everybody to look around their room that they're sitting in, and how much stuff have you got in it? Because we've got a really interesting person we're talking to today.
We do. We are going across to Florida to talk to Professor Carol Matthews, and she is the Professor and Vice Chair for Strategic Development in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Florida, and her interests are in OCD, anxiety, and related disorders, including hoarding.
And that is the subject of the fabulous book that we highlighted a chapter from in the current issue of The Science of Psychotherapy.
That's right. Recognizing and Treating Hoarding Disorder, How Much is Too Much?
Yes. So I think this is a subject we don't know terribly much about. And maybe I'm just projecting my own thing because I don't know a lot about it, but I know a lot more after reading some of her book. So how about we go over to Florida, talk to Carol?
Absolutely. Let's go to Florida. Carol Matthews, thank you so much for joining us here on the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. How are you?
I am doing great. Thank you and happy to be here.
And Richard saying hello to you here. I'm from down in Sydney and Matt's up in Brisbane and you're in Florida. How fantastic.
Yes, it's actually great to be here. There's a hurricane coming, but it hasn't hit us yet. So.
Oh, that's that beautiful confidence, isn't it? Okay. Oh dear. Well, best wishes. Hope that's you're all safe with that. But here we've got you in because of this fascinating book that you wrote. Now you've obviously been doing this work for a while because we know how long it takes to write a book and how much effort goes in. But on the subject of hoarding, which I think is under-knowledged, we just don't know enough. And I think people are coming into therapists with this problem. And sometimes it's in the background. They don't know what to do with it. And so they kind of let it out. So would you maybe just give us a little bit of a background? How did you get into this area? And how did the book eventually come into being?
So it's a great question. I actually came into hoarding through my work on obsessive compulsive disorder. And it's one of my favorite things as a scientist and a clinician, which is that when you're treating patients and doing research, you come across things that don't fit what you expect them to look like. And so I had a number of patients who had hoarding symptoms, and those symptoms didn't respond the same way to treatment that I would have expected them to. With classic OCD. And in the scientific area, people with hoarding symptoms also did not fit the patterns I expected. And so I started to do a little research and realized that hoarding at that time was beginning to be thought of as a different diagnosis than OCD, even though psychiatrists and psychologists classically characterize it as a subtype. So it was really one of those kinds of things where symptoms and patients and data did not fit my expectations. And so I had to go looking for why they didn't fit my expectations. It's my favorite thing about being a scientist and a clinician is when things don't fit what you expect. So I started looking into patient profiles and data and started talking about hoarding in the context of dementia and got interested in some of the brain patterns and some of the kind of research that was happening in the dementia world. And it's all uphill from there.
Jessica, if we could dive straight into some definitions. And so my first question is, what is the difference between hoarding and simply just collecting things?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So hoarding is actually very different from collecting. Hoarding is difficulty in discarding an item, that is likely to be unneeded or excessive. Collecting is an active process of looking for something that will fit a schema or a pattern or a previous collection, finding items, putting them into a group of other items that are similar, showcasing them. Hoarding is very passive in the sense that you can acquire things as a part of hoarding, but the core feature in hoarding disorder is difficulty getting rid of unneeded or unwanted or excessive items. And so collecting is an active process that people enjoy, and hoarding is a process that is in many ways more passive, although there can be an active component to it, but people don't enjoy it. It makes them anxious.
Because it's this thing of not discarding, which is really interesting. I remember one I saw, and there were the little free gifts that you get at, I don't know, was a supermarket or a fast food chain or something. And they were just all over the place. Obviously, they'd been bought with whatever, but never discarded. And it certainly wasn't anything they were collecting or putting in any frame. So it really pictured that. So that's interesting.
Kid, I knew a farmer who, when he was out working sort of remotely on the farm, he would not throw anything away. And these are things like bits of metal and any tools and bits of machinery that has been, broken down. And the reason was because out in a remote place, you never know, you might need that bit of steel. But then after retiring from that and coming into suburbia, he was in this pattern of never getting rid of anything. And so his wife said that he was a hoarder, but it had come out of a learned pattern, that's the way that you survive, you make it through. And his carport was, overflowing with stuff, but he would argue that it's all useful stuff that he may need at some time. Now, would that be considered as hoarding?
So it depends. So there is a concept of saving, and a lot of people who are raised in adversity or who were born in the Depression era, for example, save things that they might need in a time of scarcity. And there are many farmers and other people, retired people who are living on limited means, who save things. When it becomes hoarding is when it becomes a problem. If your living or workspaces are not usable or your life is impaired, then it becomes hoarding. And if his carport is full, that may not be a problem unless he can't use it for something else. If he needs to put his car in it and cannot do that, then we would consider it a problem. If he can't get rid of any of those things in his carport, he might have a problem. So there is an area that's gray where people may collect more than they need and be unwilling to get rid of things, but not really be impaired. And we would not consider that to be hoarding disorder, although they might be at risk for developing hoarding disorder. So it is, it's not a one or the other. There is a spectrum.
Yeah, when we just started the discussion, I jotted down the word safety. Now, is this something, because they're very interesting where you just use that word saving. So people would save things, but is that for their safety? Is when it becomes even, if I throw this away, something bad is going to happen to me. Is that becomes sort of a psychologically debilitating disorder in that frame?
So in the frame that you're talking about, if I throw something away, something bad will happen to me, is actually more of an OCD symptom. And you can actually see it in the context of OCD. So that's what we would call magical thinking. If I throw this away, my mom might get sick. That's an OCD type of a hoarding symptom. But a more classic belief system for somebody with hoarding disorder would be, if I throw this away, I or somebody else will need it in the future and I will never be able to get it again. So it's this unknown possible need that's more common.
That's a very important distinction. That's really clarified it in just a sentence or two. What do you think, Matt? That's cool, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Now, historically, there's been some rather extreme examples of hoarding, which you again touch on in the article, the chapter that we've published in The Science of Psychotherapy. So I'm wondering, would you just pick on maybe one of those and just give us an insight into some extreme versions of hoarding?
So there are a few that I touch on in the book, and I think there are two that are quite interesting. Well, they're all quite interesting, actually. But the Collier brothers are probably the most famous of the hoarding stories, and they're one of the original stories. They were two brothers, sons of a gynecologist who lived in one of the boroughs in New York. and really never let anything leave their home. So they collected everything that their father had ever owned, including some pickled organs from his medical practice, all of his medical paraphernalia. They kept every item, including garbage, that came into their home and never let it out of their home. One of them would actually go scavenging at night. So hoarding can involve collecting in some cases, actually in many cases. And so one of the two brothers would go scavenging at night, picking up anything that he was interested in off of the streets that had been abandoned and bringing them into his home. And this was actually sensationalized in the popular press, but it was extreme. And actually the way that it was finally solved was actually by the deaths of the two brothers. So the police and other authorities had tried to intervene many, many times, and they were very paranoid and thought that people were trying to break into their homes to get valuables. And so they set up traps and tunnels and barricades to prevent people from coming into their home. And it was only when there was a smell of decomposition and decay that the police finally broke into the home and found one of the two brothers dead, and actually were nearly buried in the hoard. But he had been buried in a collapsed tunnel underneath the hoard. And his other brother, who had gone missing, was found several weeks later and had probably died prior to him. So this is one of the most extreme examples of hoarding, where their entire house was filled with tons and tons of refuse, and it eventually led to their death.
I can sort of go halfway to understanding collecting objects that may have some utility or emotional connection. But when it comes to like plastic cups and straws and garbage, basically.
Yes, actual decomposing refuse.
What is going on in the mind of a hoarder when they're collecting garbage?
So I don't know what's going on in their minds. I'm quite interested in that question, but I think it speaks a little bit to the idea of insight. So whether you actually recognize in and of yourself that what is happening to you is a problem, whether you see yourself as having something that is causing impairment. And people will tell you that they keep those containers or those bags because they may need them and they don't know quite how many they're going to need, so they don't want to get rid of any of them. Refuse is a little bit more difficult. I also have families who are patients who will tell me that they need to keep food even though it's spoiled because they might need it, recognizing full well sometimes that spoiled food is not edible or not good for them. But often they just lack the ability to make the decision to throw it away. So sometimes, actually, though, those people don't come to my attention very frequently because they don't always see that it's a problem. If you say to them, you have spoiled food in your refrigerator, they may be forced to recognize it in the moment, but they may not actually hold on to that knowledge that this is a problem. They're not psychotic, they're not delusional, but around this, they don't have the insight that this is problematic.
So that sort of begs the question, with people coming into our therapy rooms, how do we identify, because we're not in their homes, we don't see any of this going on, how do we identify that there might be a problem in this area?
So one of the things I talk about in the book is easy ways to screen people for hoarding. And you can ask a few fairly simple questions. And actually one that didn't make it into the book because they haven't validated it yet but it's turning out to be highly predictive, is a simple question, which is, how often are you unwilling or unable to let somebody into your home because you're embarrassed or ashamed of the amount of clutter that's in there? If you answer sometimes or always, the chances are over 80% that you have a problem with hoarding. So we're still working on that question, but just asking one or two questions about letting somebody into your home, or whether you can use your bed because you have a clutter problem. Can you use your kitchen table because you have a clutter problem? So relatively straightforward questions.
There is an awareness that, so if you're embarrassed that you don't want to let someone in your house because you're aware of the clutter. So there's an awareness that there's something not right here.
Many people, not for everybody, but for many people. But I think that even people who have poor insight will be reluctant to let someone into their home. They may not admit as to how much hoarding they have or what the problem is, but they will be aware to the point where they will not let someone into their home.
Quite interesting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because the prevalence of it is, I suppose it's been highlighted by the fact that there were a number of television programs made about it, and I suppose they were trying to show the example, and hopefully people who were hoarding would watch it and follow the resolutions. Do you have any opinion about the methods that were used or some recommendations now, I suppose, moving into, but what do you do as a therapist when you're working with them?
So that's actually a great question. And you do have to have some expertise, but we've also done some work in my lab to show that peers who have lived experience of hoarding can be trained in a relatively short time to be very effective therapists for people with hoarding disorder. So there are a few stages to the treatment. One is to get people to identify where the problem is. So they may not actually identify the hoarding as a problem, but they may identify that their grandchildren can't come to their house as a problem. And so working towards where the problem is and what they identify as the problem is one stage. The other stage that I think is really important is for many people, there's not a cure, there's not a resolution, so harm reduction is the model. So San Francisco, which has got a task force related to hoarding and cluttering, has a brilliant solution to this in some of the dense urban living areas that exist in the Bay Area. So the police and the fire department define safety as a certain number of inches from the smoke detectors and the fire exits, a certain number of inches or feet from the heating units. You need to have a certain amount of space to be able to get in the door. So they define it on the basis of safety, and they don't try to change an individual's living situation. What they try to do is make them safe in that situation. Now, a lot of people actually want help for hoarding, and many people can get treatment. And so under those circumstances, you use a form of cognitive behavioral therapy where you practice discarding things in session, you practice discarding things at home. You get what we call a clutter buddy, something built on the Alcoholics Anonymous model, where you have somebody to help hold you accountable to discarding. My patients send me emails whenever they're discarding things to hold them accountable. So it's a mixture of cognitive behavioral therapy, something called motivational interviewing, which is where you find the patient's motivation to change, and accountability. So a mixture model, which is probably the most effective.
Can I ask, in terms of demographics and culture, are we seeing any patterns?
So not in terms of demographics and culture. It seems to be as prevalent in men and women. So it's not predominant one over the other. We see more women in treatment than we see in men, but it appears to be just as common in men. It is much more prevalent in older adults than it is in younger adults. So the prevalence in younger adults is about 2%. The prevalence in adults over 60 is about 7%. So quite an increase. But it does appear to be in existence in all the cultures that we have looked at, although we haven't looked at all cultures extensively. Now, in some places, it's well accommodated. I do research in Costa Rica, and there have been a number of patients or actually research participants that I've worked with who said, yes, I have a hoarding problem, but it's not a problem because I've been able to put it in this bodega in my backyard, and it's not in the way. And so it begs the question as to whether they have hoarding disorder, because it's not impairing their lives, but there's an ability to accommodate it. When you can't accommodate it, then it would become a problem for that person.
It's a hoarding hobby.
Yeah, it's a hoarding hobby. But this is the interesting thing, as we talk about it, and also we talk about it with psychopathology, this impaired life experience sort of quality that someone, can have schizophrenia, can have bipolar, can have a lot of autism, a lot of difficulties, but they're high functioning or they're functioning successful. So we can see that because there was that interesting show, we quite like it, the American Pickers. And they go out and they find these places and they've got all these millions of things. But there seems to be these very large properties with lots of, sort of buildings. So it doesn't necessarily, as you say, interfere with their life. But as they're sort of wandering through these barns full of stuff, I do sit there going, I think you might be a hoarder.
Well, they actually might be. And there was a family that I studied years ago that did that for a living. They definitely had hoarding disorder and some of their homes were impassable. But they actually had a similar kind of a job where they would move homes from one physical location to another. And they would collect all of the detritus and the belongings that had been left behind. And they would bring them to their homes. And actually, they had consignment stores. So some of it they would sell in consignment stores, but some of it they would keep. So it was an interesting mix of adaptation and benefit, but clear impairment because their homes were definitely not, or at least partly usable, in particular the patriarch of that family. And I think that speaks to the key, which is that the definition of hoarding disorder, not a hoarding problem, but hoarding disorder, is whether it actually causes functional impairment. The person, though, may not actually recognize that they have impairment. It may require an objective observer to recognize that they are at risk for falls or that they have vermin in their homes or that their shed is at risk for catching fire because there's so much paper in it. So there is a question as to who determines impairment that is an empiric question, I think, still.
And I guess if we go back to demographics, if you are wealthy and you have large properties and you can accommodate your hoarding, it's going to be a lot less obvious than someone who is poor and has a small house and doesn't have the room. And so maybe, I don't know, I'm just thinking out loud here, maybe our perception is this is more a low socioeconomic kind of problem rather than a wealthy person's problem. But you said across the board, it's the same problem.
Yeah, that's interesting.
You're right, though, that we did a study actually interviewing clinicians who specialize in hoarding disorder, and some of them actually said, if you're wealthy and you can accommodate your clutter, you do not have hoarding disorder. I disagree with that. I actually think that's that harm reduction model. If you can negotiate such that the problem that you have is not impairing, that doesn't mean you don't have the disorder. It means you've been able to manage the harm reduction model such that your functioning is as good as it can be. Somebody with fewer resources who's lower socioeconomic status or has less physical space might be more impaired. But that actually is speaks a little bit to the creativity of the harm reduction model. I do not argue, contrary to some of my colleagues, that wealthier person does not actually have hoarding disorder, because to me, the fundamental problem is the difficulty in discarding. The clutter is a secondary manifestation of that.
Yeah, it's just the imperative. Just one other thing. Because you're saying the when they have their own safety and when that becomes imperiled and various things, do neighbours come under some kind of concern? Are they the ones that can sometimes trigger that their neighbour is a hoarder because of smells or whatever? You know?
Yeah, so in extreme cases, so I do want to note that not everybody and not even most people with hoarding disorder get into that extreme situation. But for those people who do have an extreme problem, when they have infestations or smells or garbage, neighbors do get involved. And I do talk a little bit in the book about the rights of the person with hoarding disorder and the rights of the society around them. And there is a balance. A person with hoarding disorder has a psychiatric illness. They have rights under the Americans with Disabilities Act in the United States. There are active ways to help, again, do the harm reduction, but harm reduction needs to involve the entire neighborhood. So you don't want rats in the neighborhood or other vermin. And so that would be a mitigation procedure that would take into account the harm to the neighborhood in those extreme cases, or the harm to a child. If there's a child in the home who can't do their homework because there's not a clean space, that also would be taken into account in that harm reduction model.
Okay, brilliant.
Yeah, that interesting balance between the freedom to live in your own, and you know, to live in your own space the way you want, and that balance of social acceptability and social safety. It's a bit of a balanced thing, but it does bring my mind back to the people functioning successfully with quite difficult mental disorders, that we actually say, let's leave you alone a little, or let's not leave you alone, let's just allow you to manage, as you say, as to cope with situations and to harm minimise. That might be a reasonable way to think about rather broad swathes of social problems.
Yes, because when I think of myself as a clinician and projecting my own how I like to live in my space and projecting that onto the client, I mean, I'm imagining you could be crossing all sorts of lines there, trying to project your own what you would consider, you know, safe and healthy and optimal in your living environment to the client, where the client could possibly be much happier in a much more cluttered environment.
No, I think that's right. And we want to maximize quality of life, but I don't define what quality of life is. My client does.
Yeah.
And I do take into account some of the objective measures, because quality of life may be impaired by their physical surroundings in some way. And so that will matter. But my goal is not to take away their clutter unless they want that to happen. My goal is to maximize their health and well-being, and that may involve letting them keep their clutter if that is the best outcome for them.
Yes, but just help them to do it in a way that's successful. And again, it's really beautiful in the book, going through all these different ways in which you work and the different case studies of reminding us that it's the therapist's goal to assist the client, is to take the client from a place of difficulty to a place of less difficulty. Rather than, as Matt was saying, there is a tendency in some spaces for a client to say, well, if you were sort of a little bit more like me, then everything would be fine. And it's a good reminder each time we come across these things. of our responsibility to care for the clients, care for themselves.
Right, right. I am not there to tell them what to do. I tell my students, our job is to meet the client where they're at and to help them get to where they want to be. Mm. We're not to determine where that is. That's not our job.
Yes, it's such a simple message, and I we probably underplayed that there, but it is where they are, and to get them to where they want to be. Is there something that we've missed that you want to tell everybody before we sign off?
I think that hoarding disorder is very under-recognized and it's very underappreciated, and it does have substantial mental health and actually medical consequences. So our work has shown, and others, the work of others as well, has shown that there are substantial medical illnesses associated with hoarding disorder. Certainly the risk for depression, anxiety, and suicide is increased. So again, and the time from diagnosis to treatment is delayed, and the vast majority of people do not know what hoarding disorder is or think of it as a quirk, so they don't seek treatment. So I think the thing that's the most important is for people to know that it is a real illness, it has real consequences, and it's actually quite treatable for many people.
Is there some training, formal training that is available? Or
there is formal training that's available. There are actually workbooks that I talk about in my book and also are available on the International Obsessive Compulsive Disorder Foundation's website. There are peer guides, and I'm a big fan of peer support because our studies have shown that it is as effective as trained therapist-led treatment and can be more empowering, is also more cost-effective and helps the therapist in addition to the clients. So that is also available on the International OCD Foundation website, the information about that. So there are many forms of treatment. There's also medication treatment, but therapy is really by far the most effective form of treatment.
Okay. Well, Carol, look, it's a fascinating topic. Thank you so much for all the work that you do and for writing this book. It's certainly a subject I need to learn more about for myself and my own practice. And we'll be sure to be pointing everyone to that resource. Thank you so much for your time today on the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. It was great to have you with us.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah,
and I just really want to say that in Australia, you have some great resources, some experts in hoarding disorder and some leaders in the field in terms of case management and community services.
Fantastic. That's great. Thank you so much, Carol. I hope everybody will get this book, and certainly you can get a great insight into it by looking at the Science of Psychotherapy magazine, November.
Thanks, Carol. We'll see you later. Great.
Bye-bye. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
That was so interesting, Matt. I mean, I know we really just scratched the surface and we just went through the basic elements, but I think those are the basic elements that we need to clarify with a lot of therapists.
Yeah, I think it's a tricky one. Like some of these, you know, really extreme cases are very obvious. You know, people can't get in or out of their houses. There's so much stuff. That's obvious. But where is the line, like between just collecting a little bit too much stuff to hoarding? I think it's very subjective. I think it's a tricky one to navigate. I need to read the book.
Yeah, we need to read it. But it does open that possibility that when you've got a client who's talking about difficulties they're having, about family not visiting them or being embarrassed about or having some shame issues, mm-hmm. that simple question of, you know, and how easy is it to use your kitchen table or how... So they were not terribly invasive and not terribly embarrassing, but could suddenly give you that insight. So again, we've opened another doorway of possibility for therapists to understand, which I think is really cool.
Yeah. So if you want a bit of an insight and you're a subscriber to the Science of Psychotherapy, jump into the latest issue. We've got an article there, which is a chapter out of the book. And just a reminder again, the book is Recognizing and Treating Hoarding Disorders, How Much is Too Much by Carol Matthews, and it's a Norton publication.
Fantastic. So jump on there. We'll have links. And if you're not a subscriber, why not? Anyway, but come in. I mean, we get the magazine regularly. We've got lots of archive material going back. I mean, marvellous things. In addition to the magazine with Carol, we've got John Arden. We've got, something by me. But there's lots of great sort of ways in which to expand our knowledge through these interesting topics through being a subscriber. And you can also access our academy, which is also a fantastic thing.
Fantastic. All right. Well, thank you, Richard. And thanks, everyone, once again for tuning in to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. And we will catch you next time.
Bye for now.
Thanks for listening to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. For more great science, go to thescienceofpsychotherapy.com.